You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Just ahead, brick and mortar retail sales rose throughout most of last year against all odds. The National Retail Federation keeping track. What does that mean for e-commerce and people's shopping habits? How are stores doing in your downtown? 800-642-1234 to join in. We will get insight from a UW retail analyst. But first, Wisconsin had more than 300 homicides last year. That's a 70% increase from 2019. Law enforcement agents say there are just too many guns on the streets, and some politicians are using the deaths as political talking points. Corrine Hess has more.
Torondo Long used to spend his mornings taking long walks around his Kenosha neighborhood. His sister, Ramonda Thomas, says exercise brought him joy. Long turned 28 on Valentine's Day, 2021. For his birthday, his mom and sister gave him new workout clothes and a pair of headphones. He was wearing the gifts the next morning when he was shot 3 times in the stomach during his daily walk. Thomas believes her brother thought he was being asked for directions.
He always walked early in the day. It's never like late at night or anything like that, so I don't think he worried about anything.
Long's death was Kenosha's first homicide of 2021. The city ended the year with 16 murders, up from 6 in 2019. That increase was reflected statewide. Kenosha police believe Long was a victim of mistaken identity when he was gunned down. Kenosha's interim police chief, Eric Larson, says guns have become the fallback in arguments leading to more deaths.
And we've seen that in many circumstances, whether it be at taverns, on the street, all these different locations, including some of the domestics.
For Thomas, her brother's death changed the way she thinks about her hometown.
We know now that we can't live in a world where you can go anywhere and be anywhere at any time, because you can be walking down the street and get killed at 9 in the morning. Then you're not really safe.
Wisconsin had 315 homicides last year. About 200 of those were in Milwaukee County. And this year is already off to a deadly start. By February 22nd, Milwaukee County had already seen 38 homicides. Last year's 38th homicide was recorded on April 11th. Some politicians, now in the throes of campaigning, are turning the statistics into talking points. Milwaukee's acting mayor, Cavalier Johnson, would like to see a portion of the state's $2.9 billion budget surplus used to address Milwaukee's challenges with public safety. But that's unlikely. Governor Tony Evers says he has directed $45 million in COVID federal aid to local governments for public safety. He pushed the issue to the Republican-led legislature and called for an increase to shared revenue payments to municipalities.
We've had great trouble with the Republicans getting shared revenue increased in the state. That's the money that those municipalities use to do their work, including fire and police protection.
But some people have felt desperate and lacked confidence in police. That's why University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee criminologist Theodore Lentz says he would have been surprised if there had not been an increase in violence in the last 2 years.
We kind of had the perfect storm. We had the COVID-19 pandemic. And when you couple that with the massive amount of social unrest that we had with the protests and, you know, additional incidents, police shootings and things like that, that just kind of kept that sparks thriving.
Criminologists like Lentz don't have an exact answer about why the crime wave of the 1990s slowed, and they don't know what will make this spike in homicides go down.
It's thinking too about, well, you know, who's at the highest risk for violence? You know, if we see some positive changes, are they part of that positive change?
Back at the Thomas home, Long's memory lives on in photos scattered across the living room.
He was really big in our family because, you know, he was the firstborn.
It's a February afternoon, but the family's Christmas tree is still up. Thomas says her brother loved the holiday.
He came and wrapped all of our gifts. We kind of hold on to that.
Homicides are trending up this year again. And unless something changes, there will be even more families like this across Wisconsin trying to keep memories like these alive. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And now many retailers that had been with us for a long time shuttered a large number of stores last year, not to mention what happened in 2020. Just remembering some of the more recent casualties, Sears, Bed Bath & Beyond, Macy's, to name a few. How has the pandemic changed your shopping habits? What do you buy online versus what do you pick up in brick and mortar stores? 800-642-1234. Jerry O'Brien is Executive Director of the Kohl's Center for Retailing at UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. Jerry, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
It's nice to talk to you this morning, Kate.
Well, retail sales grew last year faster than online sales, and that's federal data there. Were you surprised that the brick and mortar stores did so well?
No, I don't think I was surprised. There was such a pent-up demand, not just for shopping, but just to get out and be with people. So as restrictions began to fade, it was actually probably the first nice step back to normalcy.
I would imagine, too, that made a big impact on these retailers that were so hungry to get traffic into their stores.
Oh, certainly. You know, having to close your store is not just bad for the retailer, but for their communities and certainly for their employees. A lot of retailers were just so anxious to, again, be able to serve the needs of everybody who counts on them.
Also, surprisingly, our country saw more chain stores open last year than close, and that was from CoreSite Research. Have physical stores figured out how to survive in these times of when we just click on the computer and buy it online?
Well, yeah, I think all retailers, all stores are trying to figure out how do I meet the consumer where they are? And that's changed dramatically and certainly accelerated. So there was already a move to more and more online sales, but the pandemic probably jumped us ahead 5 or 6 years. Hmm. So retailers have been, you know, listening to customers and saying, what do you want? Changing assortments, meeting them where they want to be met.
What about that online to in-store marriage, if you will? How do you see the buy online, pick up in-store trend working out at this point in the retailer's toolbox?
Well, first off, I think it's here to stay. So if any retailers are thinking, whew, I'm glad I'm done with that, I would say that's a mistake. But how I see it is, again, kind of back to this assortment, acknowledging that you're going to have customers who do some of maybe their basic shopping online just to fill their needs. And, you know, if I look at grocery in particular, you might see someone who say, once a month, I'm going to get all my basics online, but I still like to go in and shop the deli and the bakery and look for the artisan cheeses. So their in-store trip might be less, but their online trip will be more. And the combination is not bad at all.
Along those lines, I think it was interesting, Jerry, that you saw Kohl's and Amazon partner up, Amazon putting their lockers at the front of Kohl's stores, Amazon returns, and you see the line there at that returns desk. What do you make of that move?
Well, the industry actually kind of howled. They were like letting the fox into the chicken coop, but as it turns out, it was pretty brilliant. Kohl's has historically got a customer that's a little bit on the older side of the population, and the Amazon shopper represented a demographic that they have been really working to attract. It gets them into the store. Often think, you know, you go to do a return, it's probably something you wanted that just didn't work out. Now Kohl's has a chance to sell that to you on the spot. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of parts of it, the convenience, reaching out to some new shoppers and actually increasing sales. It's worked out quite well.
So you think that type of marriage is kind of here to stay, where Amazon has a presence in Kohl's stores for now, at least?
Oh, I'm sure they're both going to look at the numbers themselves. I think it's worked out very well for Kohl's. At Amazon, I don't know how they're thinking about it, but it appears to be successful, so I wouldn't think it's going away.
Jerry O'Brien leads the Kohl's Center for Retailing at UW-Madison, has helmed this research and industry center for the past 14 years. Are there items that you'd never buy online? What trends have you noticed from online retailers? Do you feel loyal to your local mom-and-pop stores? How do you try to support them? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Jerry O'Brien here on the Ideas Network. We'll be right back. We're trying to make sense of the ever-changing world of retailing here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Fast Company yesterday came out with four predictions on how brick-and-mortar stores will continue to evolve this year. Number one, retailers accept more types of payment. Prediction number two, should inflation continue or not, those that deliver hyper-personalized experiences will thrive. Do you go to a store for the experience, whether it's comforting or personal attention or just being around people again? Do you own or work in a store? How are your sales doing? 800-642-1234. Jerry O'Brien directs the Kohl's Center for Retailing at UW-Madison with us for about 10 more minutes. So, you know, Jerry, we've heard it time and time again that locally owned businesses thrive on the personal touch, the personal shopping experience. Do you think that is still as true as ever?
Yes, to a point. I think it's also important that their product have a differentiation.
Okay.
So the experience is important, and you could include that part of the experience is knowing my customers well enough to provide them with an item that they are not apt to find elsewhere.
So what type of, how do you make sure you can deliver on that for a mom and pop store, a locally owned business? How do you work to try to compete there with what this vast marketplace provides online?
It's certainly more of a challenge with the online world where your customers are shopping well beyond the neighborhood that you're in. But having said that, there are an awful lot of producers out there that are not capable or have no desire to sell to the giants. So they're small batch producers. Also, there are items from large producers that are kind of on the fringes of their assortments that might fit your customer better than in a mass retailer, say Target, Walmart, Amazon.
So you really have to do your research to know what products you should offer locally.
I think that's the key to everything. Listening to customers. Customers determine what's on everybody's shelves, whether you're big or small. And, you know, the idea that you could compete with some of these people that are buying, you know, 10 million of an item is probably unrealistic. So the idea is to have those items that you don't compete with them on.
Well, I've been keeping an eye on those storefronts and mm-hmm. the strip malls and the shopping malls. What are you seeing out there? What does it look like as you look at the real estate?
Yeah, I wouldn't want to own them all right now. Certainly, there is a lot more open retail space than there's been in quite a while. I think there's a good chance that will bounce back. But, you know, in the face of actually having to close and not being listed as an essential part of the economy, these stores that close, particularly the smaller brands that didn't have the wherewithal to survive an extended period with no income while still trying to pay rent, perhaps in a strip mall or a mall, The question now is how strongly will consumers go back? There's certainly some stores we won't get back. They probably weren't that strong going into this, and this ended their existence.
So what brands do you think are built to thrive in an inflationary market?
Yeah, you know, to list brands would be difficult right now, but certainly we've seen some success in some Midwest brands. We've talked a little bit about Kohl's. They've done a lot of interesting things, you know, adding Sephora to them so to draw more traffic again. They've added a new athleisure brand. Certainly a lot of fashion retailers are realizing that formal work apparel is maybe not coming back, at least not very quickly, and have moved to the athleisure. Target has thrived during the pandemic. You know, certainly having groceries gave them a stability that allowed them to stay open. Their omni-channel is great. I just read last week they're going to consider doing drive-up returns and drive-up Starbucks coffee.
Oh, now you're talking.
There you go.
I want
a lot of people's attention.
I bet. Well, I want to pause here because on Target, because you're former stomping grounds. But, you know, when you use the app in store and you look for deals or you scan barcodes for prices in your cart, that item you scan always shows you the price online, which often doesn't reflect the price on the shelf. And so when you get to checkout, you have to ask for the lower price. And sometimes, you know, that is a real mismatch, bumpy gray zone between online prices and in-store prices. What's going on there?
Well, first off, I'm sure they'd like to get it fixed as quickly as they can, because this conversation does happen. You said my old stopping ground. It's been a long time since I've worked at Target, so I can't tell you exactly what's going on there.
What is it, like 06 or so?
Yeah, very good. But what I will tell you is, there's an effort to match prices locally. So mm-hmm. You're trying to say, oh, one of my competitors down the street has this price, we should lower it. But that's not easy to do in a national price online. Mm-hmm. So there is some mixed match. Having said that, I'm sure these types of things we'll be able to figure out, particularly the idea that they know that you scanned it in the store. So if you're using one of their rewards programs, I think there's a way to match that up. Having said that, I'm not the tech genius that will fix it, but I would assume that it won't take long for it to get fixed.
Jerry O'Brien with us, Executive Director of the Kohl's Center for Retailing Excellence at UW-Madison's School of Human Ecology, as we look at retail trends, the bounce back that we've been tracking here in brick and mortar last year, and what the future holds for those stores in your strip malls, in your downtowns. 800-642-1234 to join in. How has the pandemic changed how you shop, and what do you buy online? What stores have you returned to, and do they feel and look the same, or have things changed? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Let's look more closely at Kohl's here. Kohl's Department Store has had a real turbulent run recently. Sales have been up and down in the pandemic, and even though it's increased its dividends, its stock price continues to lag. What do you think the chain can do to get more, to be more on a stable footing?
Well, I think the key to any retail chain is sales and profit. And I think they're doing a lot of right things. They're trying to predict the market right now with pandemics and the world issues that are going on right now, it is difficult. I think consumer confidence is a little bit shaken. There's an awful lot of people don't have confidence in retail in general right now. Like, mm-hmm. They think that the state of the industry is pretty poor. But if you look at, try and take care of your customers, which is the key for every retailer. Honestly, I don't see a lot of problems at Kohl's. Their sales are up. Their dividends are up. They've reduced inventory while increasing sales, which is kind of a nice sweet spot to be in. They appear to continue to invest in things that consumers want. So their checkouts are easier. The returns, we've talked about adding Sephora and Amazon and new brands. So I think they're doing a lot of things that are right for the market to recognize it. I think it's just going to have to be multiple quarters in a row where they get the results that they had this last quarter.
Okay. What about supply chain? That's been a huge struggle, delivering products on time and not having some bare shelves. What is going on there, and how are retailers dealing with supply chain issues?
Yeah, it's interesting. There's the kind of the macro event. Certainly, imported goods are a challenge right now. And quite frankly, looking at the global tensions right now, that may not get better in the near future. However, everyone then are trying to diversify where they get their product from to not be such at risk if there's a problem in one area. Then there's trucking. So we can get the product, if we can get it into a port, can we truck it across the country to Wisconsin? Those are the big issues. But often the issue that you see in the store is also part of the labor shortage locally. So you may go into a grocery store and find an item not on the shelf. And if you ask around a little bit, you may find out that, yeah, actually they have a trailer of product, but they're having a hard time getting it unloaded to the floor. So the supply chain is from beginning to end a challenge right now.
So I'm hearing supply chain and workforce issues, just having the people in place to do the work as well has been really difficult.
It's very difficult for retailers right now. And again, there's a number of reasons. In an era of pandemic, retail probably does not seem as one of the safest places to work. Mm-hmm. Having said that, a lot of retailers have gone to extremes to try to do what they can to protect, and it seems to work. Now, obviously, hopefully we're on the downhill side of this pandemic, so some of those items might get better pretty quickly.
Jerry, thank you so much for joining us.
I enjoyed the conversation, Kate.
Jerry O'Brien is Executive Director of the Kohl's Center for Retailing Excellence at UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. Just ahead this hour, we talk with a novelist and the director of the Iowa Writers Workshop about her new murder mystery that is set in a fictitious Wisconsin town. It's called Haven, as we explore the experience of Chinese American immigrants. Have you read the book, The Family Chow? What do you want to ask its author? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up. News update is next. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. In dark times, when you're feeling homesick or defeated, there is really nothing like a good steaming soup and dumplings made from scratch. What a line from the novel The Family Chow, set in a fictitious town called Haven, Wisconsin. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This gripping novel is at the intersection of a multitude of tensions, like race and culture, the American dream, identity, belonging. Have you heard about or read The Family Chow? Maybe your book group is taking it up. What do you want to ask its author? 800-642-1234. Lan Samantha Chang is director of the Writers' Workshop at the University of Iowa. Her new murder mystery, The Family Chow, is set in the home state of her childhood, that is Wisconsin. Samantha, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. It's great to be here.
Oh, my goodness. I couldn't help it, but as I was reading with my Wisconsin radar on alert, just keeping an eye out for anything that might have hinted to me that it was Wisconsin. And, you know, that wasn't really necessary because I grew to understand that the themes and tensions that you bring out could reside in any smaller community with a tight-knit minority community. Can you tell us about your coming of age in Appleton and how it influenced what you wrote about here?
Sure. I was born in Appleton in 1965, and my oldest sister, who was 10 at the time, told me that we integrated the town, that we were the first Chinese American family to live in the town for any length of time. And I do remember growing up with two other families. They both had boys, and so my sisters and I were the Asian girls in town. Appleton at the time, you know, was not a small town. It was a small city. Mm-hmm. And it had a lot of different, you know, people of different backgrounds. But primarily, I would say everyone was white. You know, there were German Americans, Irish Americans, you know, many communities of different faiths. As I grew up, there were more and more Chinese Americans. Most of them, I think, came to Appleton because of jobs at, you know, paper making
mills.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Engineering jobs. There, many from Taiwan, and my parents became friends with them, and they tried to start a Chinese school, which sort of didn't really go perfectly well because a lot of us didn't do our homework. But it was a community, and I remember that very well. A community within the town.
Your family,
and we knew a lot about the families.
Your family would drive to Chicago once a year to buy fresh Asian ingredients and soy sauce. And it's so interesting because the food descriptions in your book, Samantha, are exquisite. And it's like you want to just, as a reader, just eat your way through your book. And I'm just wondering how that influenced how you, you know, and like Winnie in the book, you know, made the restaurant, you know, so that her white American patrons will, you know, what they would and wouldn't eat and their tolerance for the cuisine. And I'm just wondering how that influenced the element of food in your book.
I mean, my mother actually kept a list in her recipe file box of what our American friends would and wouldn't eat. My dad, you know, he was a sociable man, and he invited friends over to our house, and my mom tried to figure out how to cook for them over time. And there was a whole list I remember reading about when I was very young. And one of the things was that large pieces of beef were a big hit.
So the Family Chow is partially about three sons and their different reactions to growing up as Asian American immigrants in Wisconsin. How do you see their experiences very, very different from one another?
Well, I think this happens in so many families. There'll be more than one sibling. There'll be spaced maybe a few years apart. In this book, the siblings are spaced pretty far apart. And they'll encounter a different family depending on their birth order. So in my book, the oldest son, William Dago Chow, you know, he was the product of his parents' very youthful, sort of hopeful time in their marriage, in their Americanhood, you know, in their American lives. They had big dreams and hopes, and they thought he was going to make their lives succeed. So he grew up with these big expectations, and when he left home, he was disappointed because he couldn't quite do it on his own. He didn't have the same kind of support and belief system around him that he did in his family. The middle child, Ming, I would say, as a middle child myself, he suffers from a kind of middle child syndrome. He's very upset that he's not, you know, his parents' favorite. He goes out in the world determined to prove himself more of a success. He becomes the quintessential American success story in Manhattan with his banking job and his Ferragamo shoes. And he vows he's never going back to the Midwest. And he's just angry and upset. And he also feels ashamed of being Chinese.
Although he's fluent in Mandarin, opposed to yes. his other brother, which I found really fascinating. He's repulsed and yet he's fluent.
Right. Well, if he's a very good student. And so he goes to a, you know, college and decides if I'm going to become in any way connect to my culture, I will do it through these language lessons. I will be authentic, et cetera. The youngest child, James, I think was raised by his two older brothers. And so he's kind of a sweet, happy-go-lucky kid who mostly grew up hearing English. You know, he's close to his parents, but his brothers, you know, spent a huge amount of time with him while his parents were at work. And he is just sort of a good kid who wants to be, to please his family, to major in science and maybe go to medical school. This is how he starts the book. By the end of the book, he's in a very different place. But yeah.
I feel like we get a lot of perspective through James's eyes, although we get perspective through other characters as well. How did you feel about trying to find that mix of perspective between the brothers and whose voice should kind of carry through?
Sure. I mean, it seemed to me that James would be an ideal guide to various important scenes in the book because he's relatively innocent. And so I could sort of show him discovering his world anew as an adult, you know, his family, like learning about his family. And, you know, readers could learn also. So he is in many ways a guide in the book, but his brothers are all present as well. I wanted to make sure that the reader would understand what made each of the brothers tick and how they were different. And I feel that in a way to gain a complete picture of a family, you need to talk to everyone in it. Everyone will have a slightly different perspective.
Mm-hmm. So true.
So that seems important.
Talking with Lan Samantha Chang, a professor of the arts at the University of Iowa, author of the new novel, The Family Chow. You can join in with your questions. Have you read the book? What do you like about murder mysteries? And what would you like to ask the author? 800-642-1234. Can we talk about the multitude of names you give characters? There's a bunch of them. And, you know, starting with Dago, you mentioned earlier, the oldest son. And, you know, doesn't that mean big dog? And then later in the book, his name changes to William, which is really hard for me to accept as a reader because I know him as someone else. So what were your naming conventions here?
Sure. I mean, for one thing, the book was influenced by a brilliant Russian novel, The Brothers Karamazov, in which every character has a multitude of names and nicknames. And so it was just kind of fun for me as a writer to come up with nicknames as well. But I mean, they have their family names, which are all based on dog names. So Big Dog, Second Dog, etc. The boys. And then the brothers also have their American names. So William is one. We never find out what Ming's American name is because he insists upon calling himself Ming, which is part of this idea of being authentic in my mind. You know, learning Chinese, using his Chinese name, but at the same time having like very complicated feelings about being Chinese. And James, you know, he has his name James, and then his brothers call him a nickname. Which is based on another nickname. Chinese people in certain families would try to name their children give their children nicknames after humble objects, like in this case, dog, because it's just a way of keeping the gods from paying too much attention to the, you know, beauty and specialness of one's children, just to keep them safe. So that's part of the nicknames. In a really sort of big picture way, William's name changes to William in the second half of the book. Dago changes to William because the second half of the book shows his public life as he is seen, you know, as a sort of pretty complex character by not only the town that they live in, but by the internet society that sort of takes up the story of what happens to this family and turns it into a kind of big internet sensation.
Debacle, right? Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, that's so interesting too, because you get engulfed in a family's tensions and a family's inner struggles and their strife, and then it all turns, and then it's like the second half, you have all of this outside world judging these tensions, judging the Chinese immigrant family. Can you explain how, you know, why you approached it that way?
Sure. I was very interested in this idea of community and community within community. And it seemed to me that I was also interested in the idea of how people of various races are viewed by those who don't know them and how they're also viewed within the community. So the first half of the book is about the family. You know, this is why this book isn't quite a murder mystery per se. It's actually a family story that has a murder in it. The first half tells you, you know, basically how this family sort of works within its community of Chinese Americans and also how the members of the family see each other. And then in the second half of the book, after, you know, a mysterious death takes place, the book kind of opens up and becomes kind of a picture of how the family is viewed in the middle of this controversy by people in town and also by the sort of internet community.
And the legal system as well.
And the legal system. That's right. How the lawyers describe the characters in the family. And you can see, like, certain aspects of them being emphasized that make them sound a little more like sort of stereotypes.
Lane Samantha Chang's third novel, The Family Chow, she also has a collection of short fiction works. How do you feel about your access to books by Asian American authors or about Asian American characters? Are publishers and libraries and schools doing enough to encourage more diversity? Did you or a loved one immigrate to Wisconsin? What have you experienced here? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Samantha Chang here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about the new novel, The Family Chow, that is set in a small Wisconsin town called The Haven. And the characters, as author Samantha Chang lays it out for us readers, includes three brothers, Dago, Ming, and James, the handsome son, the accomplished son, and the good son. And that's through the eyes of the youngest son, James, that their mother, Winnie, is the heart of the family. Their father, Leo, is the spleen, who like to call them pioneers, among the first Chinese people to live in Haven. What makes a gripping story? Have you read The Family Chow? Still time, 800-642-1234. Novelist Samantha Chang with us for about 9 more minutes. Can we talk about Leo? Leo Chow can be really cruel and crushing character to his own family. And I'm just wondering how you shaped this character. What characteristics did you draw from in order to make Leo?
I mean, Leo just walked right onto the page. He was the first character.
Of course he did. He's larger than life.
Yeah. Right. He is larger than life. He is the first character who existed. He existed before I came up with the novel. I was just doodling around in between projects and this. I mean, he literally walked up into the room. And actually, when he enters the book, that's how he entered my mind as I was working on the book. I wanted to write about a Chinese-American immigrant who wasn't just quiet and well-behaved. I feel there's kind of a stereotype that Chinese-Americans are this model minority and that everybody is fine, just fine. Everybody feels like they have to behave just fine in order to, you know, fit in with that idea of how they should be. But Leo doesn't care. He's just a piece of work and a lot of fun to write about. He's very politically incorrect. Mm-hmm. That's one of his, I guess you could say, characteristics. He's loud and energetic, and he also thinks he's immortal. Like, he really doesn't think he's going to die.
Hmm. He's also pretty cruel to his eldest son, Dago, who they think that, you know, that the restaurant should be handed down to the oldest son, who is working his tail off to make it successful. And that, too, is very complicated.
Yes, I mean, that is the major conflict in the novel. I mean, it all comes out of the fact that Dago believes he should be made a partner and Leo does not. I mean, I think one of the things about succession as a literary, you know, plotline storyline is it's about mortality. And Leo doesn't want to acknowledge that he's ever going to have to turn the restaurant give it to someone, turn away from it. He wants to believe he's going to live forever. And also he wants to keep the money. Money is a big theme in this novel.
One personal thing from your family, you had talked about your family as being silent around things of the past. And this novel is very clamorous. There's so much going on. It's loud. Like, there's a lot of dialogue, people shouting at each other. And I'm just wondering, was there a contrast with the way your family went through life as you watched it as a young person versus what you created here?
Sure. Well, there were things we did not talk about when I was growing up. The main one, I think, being my dad's childhood, his story, which really, you know, was set during the Sino-Japanese War when he left home during the Japanese occupation and, you know, never was able to return to his home in Beijing and was always on his own. You know, and I think he had a kind of PTSD, really, that made it difficult for him to think about the past and definitely to talk about it. But in another way, our family was very loud. My dad was, you know, one of these larger than life characters. He was, you know, very charismatic, somewhat controlling, very full of life. He loved food and he loved jokes. He could be funny in two languages, which is impressive, you know.
It is.
He was just an amazing, amazing guy. He died in March of 2020, which is, you know, pretty recently. He lived to be 97 and a half, just full of life. I think that some of him goes into Leo. My dad, on the other hand, was a moral person. And Leo, I think, could be described as pretty immoral, always looking out for himself. So I would say that we were louder than a lot of families might be. We were always laughing and yelling. The one thing that you weren't allowed to say was shut up. My parents thought it was profoundly rude, and they told us that if we said that to each other, we'd have to go stand outside, which, as you know, in Wisconsin can be a bit of a challenge. And so we were always talking, and we were quite noisy. And I thought that I hadn't read that Chinese-American family in Asian-American literature yet. I grew up in an era where there were rules to writing fiction, and one of them was that you weren't supposed to use very many words, you weren't supposed to use exclamation points. You know, one of my teachers told his son that he was only allowed to use 2 exclamation points in his entire life. And I just decided I'm going to try to write a book that represents, you know, the feelings I had in certain parts of my life at home. And I'm just going to use as many exclamation points as I want to. I think they're 219.
Breaking some rules and writing and feeling good about
it. That's right. I just got sick of the rules.
Talking with Len Samantha Chang, professor of the arts at University of Iowa, a new novel is called The Family Chow. I want to bring up this character who I just really appreciate, Lynn Chan, in the courtroom. And so Lynn has turned to becoming this journalism major in college. And writes this blog, you know, write in short sentences, write bullet points. And so, like, jumps through all the hoops that the teacher wants, gets a C on the assignment. But it takes my breath away when Lynn is able to guide me through the court proceedings and questions whether the jury would believe a flawed but heartfelt Asian man. And at that moment, I'm really pretty stunned because there's a lot going on. Can you bring us closer to those moments?
Oh, I mean, Lynn is a character who appears very little in the first half. The only thing you know about her is that her parents are upset that she's not majoring in data analytics, but she's decided to major in journalism. And then in the second half, there's a trial, and the trial is told through Lynn's perspective through her assignment for school. And one of the things I tried to do is to show at first her following all the rules of blog writing, short sentences, bullet points, no paragraph more than 3 lines long. And then as she gets emotionally involved in the trial, she just starts to break all the rules. And that's why she gets a C. And the thing that causes her to break the rules is this moment when she's going into the bathroom in the courthouse, and this woman who's really upset with her and sees her as, you know, not to give away the plot, but an you know, Chinese American dog eating person, you know, slams the door in her face. And she starts to describe more about her feelings and to attach herself more to the characters she knows in the trial, breaking the rules of journalistic objectivity, describes her own experience in the courtroom as an Asian American woman, and she really kind of goes through a sea change in her attitude toward the whole case. By the end of it, she is understanding that there's a lot at stake, that the jury could, you know, very well not hear the defendant's testimony in a sympathetic way. Dago, who's the defendant, just to give that piece of information away, tells his story, and he tells it, you know, in a very dramatic way. He's very, very heartfelt way. But the trial has been set up so that people on the jury will see him a certain way.
And we have to leave it there. Samantha, thank you for joining us. Lynn Samantha Chang, Program Director at the Iowa Writers Workshop on the Ideas Network.